This is Haystack Help Radio on KLZ 560. Haystack Help Radio is powered by HaystackHelp.com. Finding help can be like finding a needle in a haystack, but with HaystackHelp.com, finding the needle just got easier. Now, Haystack Help Radio with Scott Watley on KLZ 560.
Welcome to Legal Talk. Thank you so much for joining us today. My name is Scott Watley. Glad to have Kevin Flesch in studio with us. FleschLawFirm.com is the website, and 303-806-8886 is the number. And with that, we will welcome Mr. Flesch himself. How are you, sir?
I'm great. How are you, Scott?
It is good to see you.
You too. It's been a while.
It's been a while for everything.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's almost seemed surreal. I mean, just unreal.
It hasn't seemed surreal. It has been surreal.
You walk around, you see people in masks.
Yeah.
Just everything has just been crazy.
Yeah, and so for a guy like myself who, you know, I'm used to doing a couple, three court appearances a day, and now I'm sitting in my office all day long and doing, we're probably averaging a couple court appearances a day right now, but it's all by video, and so just the amount of time I'm not in my car and, you know, and the sheer volume of work that we've been doing in the past, it's really given us the opportunity to change some things in our office that I think will be better and more efficient in the future. But it's definitely this pause has been interesting relating to sort of the legal world and what we're doing.
Do you see that possibly changing some things everybody more efficient?
Yeah, I would hope so. I don't know. It'll be interesting, at least relating to the criminal defense side, and whether or not the courts will allow us to appear by video in the future, because they're getting that figured out. And it's especially, I think, going to be really helpful for the outlying counties, you know, Summit County, Clear Creek, you know, all the counties to the south and east of us, all of the eastern side of the state where those judges travel anyway. I think there's going to be some real positives from this that I hope that they use the technology, because quite frankly, if you can do their WebEx product that they're using now through the court system is really pretty good. And I've been in dockets where there have been 12 to 15 lawyers, the judge, you know, and staff, and you're on a big screen and people pop in and out when they're calling cases. And it's actually very similar to being just sitting in a courtroom, because you get to hear of all the other matters and you get to hear what's going on. And it does have that same sort of feel, except you don't have the extra hour or two of travel and that sort of thing. I mean, there's still a fair amount of sitting in my office on these calls just waiting for your case to be called. I had one 2 days ago where I was sitting there for 2 hours for a 15-minute appearance. Well, that was a pretty normal court sort of scenario before. So, sure, it would be nice if they could figure out a schedule where they say, okay, you call at 9:15, you call at 9:30. But quite frankly, just being involved in it and hearing things has been good, too, because you start feeling a little bit more normal in the sense of the pattern of what things are going on, and you see that the courts are doing things. Because I know I have a lot of clients that when we continued these matters in March, and now it was the end of May, and we're continuing it again until the end of July, they kind of want to get these things done and taken care of as well and move on with their lives. And so there is some finality that you'd like to see in it. And I think we'll start seeing that later this summer and this fall. And we're starting jury trials at the beginning of July. That's going to help out. And so the system is beginning to figure things out. But to answer your question directly, I hope so. I hope there's some things that we can do that maybe will be easier. Certainly I've found that the video conferencing in the jails for my clients that are in custody, that I've been able to do that and keep communication. There's some cost to it, but quite frankly, it's equal to or less than what it would have been to drive there and the time spent just in traffic. Have seen traffic come up the last few weeks.
It's
gotten busier, and the folks that are driving crazy speeds and thinking it's a racetrack are still out there. So,
and they did, I did read something today, fatal DUI crashes were up.
Yeah, I've seen that too. And quite frankly, the work that we're doing relating to DUI offenses seem to be pretty stable or up a little bit. So the more people have been off, I think that they haven't been smart about, you know, not drinking and driving. So for those of you out there thinking about having alcohol and driving, police are out there still giving people tickets, and they may not take you to jail. They may take you to detox, or they may have you be picked up by a family member that isn't intoxicated, but they're still giving you tickets, and you still have to deal with the whole process. Right. So don't do it.
Some restaurant owners that I was talking with last week, they're kind of hoping they can keep this whole liquor thing going. Like, if you know.
Exactly.
The takeout. Takeout and delivery and all that.
You know, quite frankly, I think that makes some real sense, too. I mean, why not? I mean, as long as you're not consuming it in the car on the way home, or, you know, or having a situation where you're going to be impaired, it's another part of the service that would be really nice. And we've got we already have the wine, and you can cork it after you drink on the establishment and take it with you anyway. So that's one of the good things that may come out of this, is that you may be able to do that for those folks that like to imbibe while they're eating their meal.
Right. So just a little bit about the COVID, and we're going to get some other things. But a lot of people have been talking about workplace, and some people saying, oh, I don't want to go back to work because it feels dangerous. And some people talked about lawsuits if they got it at a work, a church, a whatever.
Yeah. So relating to workplace injuries, you know, that sort of ailment and that the disease or the virus, if you can, first of all, you have to prove that you got it from
work. That's what I've told Austin.
Yeah, but if you could, if you say, well, I haven't been anywhere else, I've been home and I've been at work, and that's it, and no one in your home has it, then the only claim that you would have would be related to a workplace injury, just like a workers' comp injury. In Colorado, the law is very clear that almost all injuries relating to a workplace scenario where you have an injury, let's say you are working at, you know, you're doing some sort of job where you're near machinery and you get your hand caught and you get injured in the machinery. You know, all of those sorts of things are still workers' compensation injuries, unless you can prove that someone was managing the maintenance of the facility that's not your employer. And the biggest thing with these claims is that you have the limited ability through workers' compensation. And that system is really good for dealing with it, but you don't get fully compensated relating to your pain and suffering. And that's generally what people want to see from these sorts of injury claims is, hey, I had a lot of anxiety, I had a lot of problems in my life because of this, I want to get paid for that. Workers' comp just doesn't do it. And so the statute is set up, and the reason that it's set up that way is because everything, all of the cost for everything would be elevated in the event that we were paying for pain and suffering and those work-related injuries. And the legislature and the public in general has said, no, we're just not going to do that. And so that's how that would happen. Now, the other aspects of our lives, let's say you go into a store, or you go back to church, you do other things that cause you to be in contact with individuals that may have it, or you're going to say, you know, that they didn't, it would be a premises liability claim where you're saying that I don't think that they were reasonable in their efforts to keep things clean and I got this COVID from it and so they should be responsible. You know, again, causation, you're going to have a real hard time proving that that's exactly where it came from. But if you could do that, you'd still have a pretty high standard of what you would need to prove that you got it, because it's airborne. I mean, there's lots of, and you're out. The other thing is contributory negligence then, right, is the idea that you'd be out in these places sort of being willing to take on that risk. So the likelihood of any sort of exciting litigation from a lawyer standpoint, I don't think there's just going to be any. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, you know, a year from now, if let's say there are lawyers and claimants out there that are willing to see if they can make a claim and make some money on this, I don't think jurors are going to have the real appetite to spend their time and efforts and make decisions about it. So I think those sorts of claims, and this is just reading sort of a crystal ball, but I would think that that most likely we won't see much in the way of litigation relating to these things. And then you've got the other aspect of insurance. Will insurance actually cover anything relating to this? Because a lot of the insurance carriers have specific exclusions sort of relating to pandemics. So if there's no money in it, then there's probably not going to be a whole lot of activity going on with it.
Sure. You're listening to Legal Talk with Kevin Flesch. Once again, Kevin's number, 303-806-8886. Real quick on the mask issue, as I mentioned, we had Tony Spurlock in, the sheriff of Douglas County, and he was saying, wow, you want to talk about tempers
Yeah.
and different things. You got people that have spit in the face of people that weren't wearing a mask.
Yep.
You've had people getting fights with store owners that were requiring to wear a mask. And he said, it's just been crazy.
Yeah. And it's such a divisive issue. And I actually saw this morning reading an article about, you know, because there's lots of, so there's some municipalities that have said you have to wear a mask.
Yeah, Lone Tree. I mean,
yep. But now there's also private businesses that have decided that you have to wear a mask in their facility, let alone what the municipalities are doing. And they're making a business decision to do that. I've also saw a article today that there's businesses now out there that, let's say a municipality isn't saying you have to wear a mask, that they specifically say we won't provide you a service or whatever we sell.
No shoot, no shirt.
Yeah.
No mask.
Yeah. No, but I've also seen now where they say if you have a mask, we won't allow you in.
Oh, okay.
So that's a whole new spin on it.
Oh, wow.
I've also heard about individuals, Republicans in particular, that have said that because there is some, it seems that there's some political motivation that's going on too, that there are some in the Republican side of the fence that have said, well, let's start wearing Make America Great masks. And see how then people feel about that. So I don't think we're going to be done with this whole controversy. I've only had one call. I had one call from someone that was cited in Denver for not wearing a mask so far. I would love to hear from people that get cited for not wearing a mask. That litigation, I think, will be interesting because I think it's completely unconstitutional. But it'll be interesting to see what the city does in prosecuting those cases and how those go. I'm trying to find a study that actually says that masks make a difference, especially cloth masks. The N95 masks, I certainly understand there may be some slight argument to be made that those would be used. But most of the people that I see wearing masks, there's no way that they're being of benefit except making people feel better.
And this morning, Disneyland, Disney World, all this, and they're going to open mid-July, requiring not only employees, but guests.
Yep.
To wear a mask.
Right. And I think the private entities are looking at it saying, we want to make sure that the government doesn't intervene with our efforts to try to reopen our business. And so they're motivated to, I think that that's the motivation. And then I think there's some business owners that do believe that the masks are making a difference. Mm-hmm. And again, I would love to have anybody tell us and cite to me a study that actually shows that. And I don't know. I mean, I understand. The way I look at it now is if I want to go into a business that says I have to wear a mask.
Your choice.
Like, yep. And
whether
it's like,
go or not.
Exactly. And it's like me putting on my shoes and a shirt. It's just another piece of equipment that I need to wear.
Well, yours is cool.
Well, you know, I'm wearing a buff because I wear these fishing and I'm like, it works. It you know, it covers my nose and my face. And actually, it works better, I think, than some of the masks that I've seen. And it is what it is. I'm fine with it. I think it's one of those things that we'll all get through this. And as long as we do it together and continue to have conversations about it and be smart about what makes sense, you know, to protect the people that really need to be protected, I think that's going to be the most critical part of this process and get people back in normalcy and get people back working, get people feeling like they mean something to the world. Because you get a bunch of people that are shut-ins and they need that help.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Once again, you're listening to Legal Talk. Kevin Flesch will be glad to help you with your legal matters, personal injury, criminal. But really, I just tell people, if you need some legal advice, call Kevin, and he will do his best to help you. And if not, he will have a contact that he can hook you up with if it's a different area. But 303-806-8886. Kevin, thought we'd talk about, you know, listen to your ads, of course, here on KLZ, and, you know, we all say trial tested, trial ready. And the trial deal has been going through some issues with all this, too, but you say in July, maybe a bit jury trials.
Yep, we're going to start up again, hopefully getting members of the community into these courthouses so that, and in groups of, you know, a jury trial, even a six-person jury trial, you've got to bring in, generally speaking, we bring in 25 to 30 people to end up with six jurors. And so obviously with all of the governor's orders relating to 10 or more being against the law in the way of group size, jury trials went away. And quite frankly, I think there's been several months now where people were feeling very uncomfortable with having that many people in a room. And generally speaking, jurors sit close to each other and there's, you know, there's the ability to spread lots of germs, not just the COVID, but sure. all kinds of other things. And so jurors are just have been uncomfortable doing that. And I think the Colorado Supreme Court came out the beginning of May with a really good order saying, you know, we understand that the public doesn't want to do this. And quite frankly, we think that it's probably the best thing for our system to hold off on offering any jury trials until the beginning of July. And July 6th is when those trials will begin. I think primarily those trials are going to be criminal trials to begin with, because those are the folks that, especially people that have been in custody through this process, those are the folks that we've got to make sure get the get the ability to have individuals in the community make decisions about guilt or innocence in their cases. And the jury trial system in our society is obviously goes back to our founding. And we're one of the few nations in the world that give you this opportunity to have members of the community come in, hear evidence, and make a decision based upon the law and what they believe the evidence is. And it's by far, I believe, the best system in the world. Yeah, you get these crazy jury verdicts here or there, good or bad for the system, good or bad for the people that are involved. But overall, I would say that my experience in almost 25 years of practice is jurors generally get it right, and they generally are doing what they think is appropriate under the circumstances. And as much as a lawyer like myself, we believe in our own minds that we'll be able to mold and change the views of 6 or 12 people, You think in your common everyday life, putting 6 or 12 people in a room and getting a consensus, because almost always it's got to be a unanimous verdict of all the people involved in that decision. That's hard in just general life, let alone doing it in a trial. And so with advocates on both sides and skilled people doing what they need to do. So, and in this time when we haven't been able to have a jury trial or be able to go forward with those sorts of processes, I've really been thinking about fine-tuning some of the things that we do, because that's one of the areas of the practice that I really enjoy doing, in the sense of the fun part about jury trials is it does let you be in contact with individuals, first of all, that you don't know, because when we pick a jury, one of the questions that they ask, the judge asks the potential jurors is, do they know me? So it becomes personal to me, and I've had lots of situations where we have 30 people in the room where a couple of them I do know. And I know either through doing legal work for them, or they've been witnesses in other cases, or just somehow know me in the community. And those are important questions to ask, because you don't want that person necessarily to be judging a client and be biased positively or negatively.
Sure.
And so, but it's fun because you get to meet people and you get to talk with them and have never met them before. And it really is an opportunity for me generally to listen to what people have to say and gauge whether or not they're being completely truthful to me, or whether they're motivated to do it or not. Right. And it's a really, the picking the jury is a fun process in the process. Many people find it unnerving because you don't know. It's a very human process, right? You get, there's lots of people that don't like to speak in front of other people in a room of 30 or 50 people. So you've got to get through that dynamic. And then what I find is important is just getting people to talk. Right. And because once you start getting a stream of consciousness about a particular topic, normally if you let someone talk, you get to figure out what their feelings are and what their both prejudices and positive aspects from the standpoint of what I'm trying to do, because I'm trying to mold a jury that's more like-minded the way I think our defense is going to be versus the prosecution in a criminal case. Or in a personal injury case, I want people to be comfortable with awarding money because of an injury. Right. And so it changes the dynamic depending upon what kind of case I'm dealing with. But really just trying to get to know the people. And then it's like speed dating, because I don't get an hour with each individual person. I may get, in a normal civil case, I may get 40 minutes, maybe an hour, to talk to all 30 people. And there's no way that you can really dive in on topics that are substantial that would really make a difference in that amount of time with that amount of people.
And you're just trying to figure out their kind of mindset?
Yeah. It's trying to have a conversation with someone to figure out down the road, because you know what the evidence is going to be, and you know when I get to a trial, I know what the strengths and weaknesses of my case, I think, are going to be depending upon the mindset of the person that's going to be making the decision. In some cases, it won't matter what I say to a person. If there's a person on the jury that has drank the Kool-Aid from what the insurance lobby says about the fact that if you're on a jury and you award a bunch of money, your insurance rates are going to go up, and they're concerned about that, you know, that person is going to be really difficult to persuade to pay money on a case when they think that somehow their money's at risk. And it's those sorts of conversations that we have. At the same time, if you get somebody that's just the opposite, and that is preconceived already that the plaintiff should win the case before they hear any evidence, well, most likely the defense is going to get rid of them. So you've got to kind of walk that tightrope to determine where people are.
Sure.
Because at the end of the day, you end up normally with a situation where people are pretty middle of the road, and you get jurors that, number one, generally don't want to be there because they've got better things to do. Because it's always the juror that doesn't have better things to do that you wonder about is whether or not you're picking the right person to make a decision in your case. And so, and you have a very limited time to do that. And so you really have got to, you know, I look at what people are wearing, what books they bring into the courthouse, sort of how they respond to other people, because there's going to be some interpersonal reactions to things. And those are all things that you can only do in person.
Yep.
Those are things that you can't do by Zoom or by, I'm not gifted enough to try to do that electronically any other way. You have to do it in person, and it has to be real time. And so that's why we're holding off and doing jury trials for a while. But once we start, then we get to start that process again. And that's just, I haven't even presented my case yet. That's just getting the case ready for people to make a decision and getting the right
and
people.
That's kind of part of the tagline there, you know, trial tested, trial ready. And we'll have to cover a lot of this on our next show. But trial ready means a lot.
It does.
Different things.
It really does. And quite frankly,
And it starts with the attorney, because you know what? There's a lot of attorneys who don't want to go to trial.
Right.
So that starts there, right?
That's exactly right. That's the first thing, is you've got to make sure that you have an attorney that, push comes to shove, they're willing to go. Because if you don't have that attorney, the insurance companies generally, especially on the civil side, the insurance companies know who those attorneys are. And they know that once they push it, they'll push it right up to the limit with their offers. They won't give all of the money that they need to, because they know that that individual or firm generally doesn't go to trial. And so once you have that reputation, it makes it very difficult to get full value. The fun part of my job, from the standpoint of meeting people, helping them, but also at the end, the preparation is all the work. Going to trial a lot of times is the most fun that I have, because I do get to interact with people, and I get to see how other human beings interact to the arguments that I make and the evidence that we have. It can be really frustrating at times, because you think you've got it dialed in the way it's really persuasive and people don't buy it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, when it happens the opposite way, it's fun. And there's always things that happen in a jury trial that you don't expect. And so I kind of like the unexpected.
And you always talk about how you explain that to your client as well. Right. Like, if you go to, hey, if we're going to go,
it's a real danger.
You never know.
Right. It's super dangerous, generally speaking, for a plaintiff in a civil case to be trying a case, unless you're not being offered anything and you have nothing to lose if you lose.
Gotcha.
But generally speaking, if you're in that situation, then let's go. Let's see what happens. Let's see what the community thinks. And I learn things from that help us in our practice to make determinations about what cases go and don't go, and what risk is acceptable and what risk isn't.
Mm-hmm.
The only way you would learn that is through trying cases.
And how many general witnesses? I mean, does every jury trial, there's always going to be witnesses?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yep. So one of the things that people, you'll hear the statement like, oh, that's hearsay. Lots of, I'll call them lay people that aren't lawyers, will use the hearsay statement, that they'll say, well, and what hearsay is an out-of-court statement used in court to prove the matter asserted. And the technical idea with that is that statement that's made out of court, that isn't tested between two lawyers, two advocates talking and cross-examining the person, is generally not allowed. And so, you know, lots of people will say, well, I should be able to prove my case with a couple of affidavits and my medical records, and I'll testify, and away you go. Well, the problem is a lot of that evidence isn't necessarily admissible without a witness testifying. So you've got to have a witness come in And unless there's not a stipulation, you have to witness come in that gives you the records for the medical provider and says, yep, these are all the records that we have in the normal course of our business, and this is a complete set of those records, and it's an accurate copy of those records. You need to have that witness come in and testify about that to lay what's called the foundation so that you then can raise an exception to the hearsay, because, again, they're written statements, but they're an out-of-court statement that are being used in court that technically are excluded without that additional foundation and the exception to the hearsay rule, which is a business record exception that allows that record to come in. I use an exception to the hearsay rule a lot relating to business records. I can get a certified record from the state courts of an order or something that has happened, a deed from from a recorder's office that is certified, and I can bring that into court and raise an exception and just enter it in as evidence. But without knowing how to go through those hoops, you would need an individual to testify about the foundation of that document to bring it in. So it's very intensive relating to witnesses. And it's much like putting together a puzzle, but you've got to have all these other pieces of people coming in to help you with that puzzle and put it together. And that's where it becomes complicated.
So you'll call your witnesses in certain order? Yes. Sometimes to build that case a little bit.
Absolutely. Too. So a lot of times, for example, many times the doctors that are treating my patients are really good advocates for them. Sometimes I have a client that isn't a very good witness. They just don't. They get nervous. They're worried about how they're going to be perceived. They don't listen to questions well. They don't respond very well. And so it could be in a case where I've got a witness that isn't, or a client that isn't very good in the sense of, I think, jury likability. I'll put them at the beginning of the case, and I'll put their best doctor at the end of the case because they're going to be the ones that the juror remember, so that we kind of create this story all the way through until the best witness, and then we're making an ask for money at the end. And so those are the sorts of things that I look at. If I've got a really compelling witness, then I'm going to be using that really compelling witness to, hopefully it's my client, at the end, so that that's what the jurors remember. They go in and at the end of it, they hear my closing argument that puts everything together, but they remember my client.
Sure.
And I highlight the fact that that witness is really somebody that was effective to them and that they need to help that person. And if that works for them, then that's how we will set up the trial, so that every one of them is different. And there's always something that's wrong with the case. Yep. And so we try to highlight the good stuff and minimize the other things so that we get the best outcome possible.
Right. Kevin's number, 303-806-8886, 303-806-8886. It is Flesch, that's F-L-E-S-C-H, lawfirm.com. You've been listening to Legal Talk. We'll be right back.
What could you do with an extra $500, $1,000, or even $1,500 per month? How would that change things for you? Would you buy a new car, pay off bills, or just feel a bit more secure about your retirement? What if I told you there's a way to make your dreams a reality? I'm talking about trading and investing in the market. Now, before you say, oh, that's not for me, just hear me out. I want to invite you to a half-day trading course so you can check this out. I promise you, you'll go away smarter than when you came in. We here at Online Trading Academy sponsor this, and we'll even send you home with a free home study video guide. Your money's doing nothing for you in a CD or mutual fund. Learn how to profit when the market's up or down. Call us now while seats are still available at 303-325-2776. Use offer code RADIO50. 303-325-2776. That's 303-325-2776.
Knowledge in Reverse is brought to you by Steve Hurley with Affordable Interest Mortgage.
Procrastination and hesitation yield the same result, no meaningful decision. Do you have questions regarding a reverse mortgage? Learn how it may work for you. Our main job is educating you on the facts. This type of mortgage is not for everyone, but it may be just right for you. Call Steve at 303-885-0254, home of Knowledge in Reverse. That's 303-885-2054. Learn the truth. NMLS 243-200, regulated by DORA. Equal opportunity lender.
David R. Cishon, certified estate planner and registered financial consultant, specializes in working with people who are planning for retirement and retired clients who want to preserve and grow their assets.
Education is the greatest equalizer is my theme. It's always been. More people know, the better their decisions are, the more comfortable they become. So when people come in, we take, some people say, an excessive amount of time learning about the client themselves, who they are, what are their feelings. I don't care how much assets they have. If their assets are important to them, that's critical to me.
Call now for your free consultation with David C. Shawn of Householder Group, 720-482-1917. That's 720-482-1917.
Securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA, SIPC. Investment advice offered through Householder Group Estate and Retirement Specialist, LLC, a registered investment advisor and separate entity from LPL Financial.
Hi, Jack Corgan. Shopping for a new car can be a harrowing experience unless you use my favorite car dealer, Len Lyles Chevrolet, just east of I-225 on Colfax, 15 minutes from anywhere. I've worked with them for more than 12 years, and I promise you, Len Lyles is not your typical car dealership. Check out their excellent reviews on Google. They are respectful of your time, not high pressure, and have very progressive pricing because low overhead really does mean lower prices. Len Lyles Chevrolet, go east and pay the least.
Chevy. Find new roads.
Rush to Reason with John Rush. Weekdays from 3 to 7 on KLZ 560.
Welcome to Legal Talk with Kevin Flesh. And we have been discussing some things with Kevin and some of our past shows as well. But just want to carry on our conversation with Kevin about being trial tested, trial ready, which you hear that from Kevin's office. And Kevin, once again, glad to have you with us.
Yeah, thank you. Nice use of the tagline. Yeah, we are.
It is. And, you know, man, there's so much in those four words.
Yes.
And so, but we're talking about the trial ready part of it now a little bit. And so we were talking about, you know, witnesses and all that and getting those prepared. So I assume you meet with witnesses.
Yep.
To go
get
over
them
prepared.
Yep.
What so they can expect.
Yeah. So the real work that's done, I mean, there's a lot of work that's being done during the trial, but what the important thing, it's almost like, you know, any other line of work where you're building something, because that's really what a trial is before the trial, all the pretrial discovery, the disclosures, all the things that you're doing in preparation for a trial. And the reason it's so important that you have a person that's willing to go to trial is because those of us that are trial lawyers understand at the end of the day, when you're in trial, what's going to be important to prove.
Right.
So if through your trial process of discovery, you don't disclose, let's say the surgeon that did your back surgery 3 years after the car accident, and you never really disclose that person and you don't give their medical records and you don't provide how much they billed for the services and all of that. Well, if you don't do that, well in advance of the trial, then when you get to the trial date and you call Dr. X and in the second day of trial and the defense lawyer gets up and says, I've never heard of Dr. X, the judge is going to say, well, when did you disclose this person? And what is it that they're going to testify about? And if you haven't disclosed them and you haven't explained exactly what the doctor is going to testify about, that witness is not going to be used. The court's going to exclude that witness from any sort of use in the trial. And so if you don't do that work ahead of time, then your really critical evidence that you want to get in will just be excluded. And the court doesn't really care about the fact that they have to exclude that evidence. They generally will say, well, you knew the rules.
Right.
And if the rules say that you have to, and the idea in modern trial techniques is that everybody knows what's going to be presented prior to trial. Civil or criminal cases, it's the same thing. Very rarely in criminal cases, sometimes on rebuttal, you'll be able to get in evidence that hasn't been disclosed because it's appropriate under those circumstances. Or as a defendant, you may not have to disclose things until very short period of time before trial. But certainly in civil cases, everything has to be developed and provided to the other side well in advance so that they can dispute it. And so it's not like what we see on TV where you have this star witness that appears, right? And that they're like,
doors open in the back and
everybody's
like,
looking. Right, exactly. Although that is a really good technique if you want to see the reaction of some people. But at any rate, it just doesn't happen in real life that you're able to do that. Everybody, 95% of the time, knows what's going on and knows what's going to be presented by that witness prior to it because they've been disclosed, their opinions have been provided, they most likely have been deposed, which is a process by which people can take statements under oath and ask questions. And those are transcribed. They're even videotaped now so that you can use a videotape in trial in lieu of a person's live testimony, or you can cross-examine with videotape. But generally, we use transcripts for those sorts of things. And all of that information is created in preparation for a trial. And so that's where the real work happens, to develop those things that are important. And so that's where you also get the sense of what these witnesses are going to be like and how they're going to be presenting in front of a jury. I've had experiences with experts, maybe not in the medical field necessarily, but other sorts of experts in a variety of areas of expertise, that their written documents and what they say and in writing looks spectacular. And they're really seem to be good witnesses on paper. But then you get in front of them and you start asking them questions, mm-hmm. and they just don't present as well. And they aren't as organized in their regular speech and how they respond to to questions. Or they're egomaniacs, and they're not going to come across very well to a jury. The jurors aren't going to like them. Same can be said for the other side, where there's experts. I've actually cross-examined experts in the past in cases where I didn't call my expert. I actually cross-examined the other side's expert, especially in criminal cases, because I had spoken with them beforehand and found them to be credible people and that they will give me the information that I need. And if I can get that credible information from the other side's expert, it even becomes even more important, because they're not on my side. They have no interest in agreeing with me unless it's fact.
Mm-hmm.
And those sorts of situations in preparing for a trial can be really helpful. And we've won cases because of that, in situations where you actually, and it's the best feeling, quite frankly, is where you use the other party's expert against them, because you know what they're talking about and what is really the truth. Because at the end of the day, you know, plaintiffs and defendants are always looking to make their side of the argument the real argument. And jurors, all the jurors really should be trying to figure out is, what is the truth? What's the real facts? And how do we make a decision with what we know to be the case?
Mm-hmm.
And without any prejudices on either side. And everybody comes in with prejudices. And so that's really the interesting part about a jury trial, is you get the advocacy on both sides. And the jury has to pick through that advocacy and prove to themselves what is real, what's reality.
Right.
And it's a very fascinating process. But there's a lot that has to be done beforehand. And the thing with the idea, with both sides knowing everything, then you get to pick apart certain things. But you can't miss the total package, really, in mm-hmm. making a decision about a jury trial without understanding each individual piece. And it's just put together like building a house brick by brick. And that's the way that I best describe it. And so, you know, sometimes when we talk about the three things that you need to prove in a civil case, liability, and that act that caused, you know, whatever it was that the person did to you, that caused you injury, and that injury then caused damage. We've got to have those foundations of things. Well, if one of those pieces of the foundations is shaky, it's like any other sort of situation, whether it's a house or, you know, something wrong mechanically with something else. If it is always breaking down, but it's a beautiful piece of whatever, you have a tendency not to value it as much. And it's the same thing in a jury trial.
Right. So with most witnesses, will you usually always cross-examine them to some degree, or sometimes you let them say, and again, you're just...
Yeah, so I'm always trying to be as effective as possible. And sometimes there's a real effectiveness in not responding and not cross-examining a witness. I've certainly done that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were talking about sort of how you put together a case and you move forward with what witnesses do you call. I had a case a few years ago, a criminal case up in the mountains, where my client was a really good witness, really believable and really dynamic. And it was a situation where, in a criminal case, generally speaking, the defendant, the person that's accused, is the last bit of evidence that the jury gets to hear. And in this particular case, that's what happened. We called him, really good. the DA didn't have any rebuttal evidence against what my client had said, and I knew that the jurors, they were remembering what my client said. So the DA got up, and the way it works with closing arguments in a criminal case is that the DA gets two bites at the apple with regard to their closing. So they get a close at the beginning, and normally they give you maybe 20 minutes for a closing argument to make to the jurors. This was a misdemeanor case. And so the DA got up, and he kind of gave a little bit about why, based upon the evidence, that they should convict my guy. But he said, wait, I'm going to come back, and I'm going to tell you these other things that are really important for you to think about. Well, the only way he gets that rebuttal argument is for me not to do any closing, which, as everyone knows that's listening, lawyers love to hear themselves talk, right? So what lawyer in their reasonable mind would not give a closing? Well, I had just finished with the direct examination of my client, and he was really effective, and the DA really couldn't do a whole lot to him in the way of what he said really happened.
Right.
And so I'm looking at it, and I turn to my client, and I say, well, he's just told us that he's got a whiz-bang, really good argument for us on the other end when I get done with my closing argument. And I said to him, you were really good, and I think they're listening to you, and they listen to you through your process. I don't think I'm going to do any advantage to you to get up there and argue. And if I don't get up there to argue, then he doesn't get his second close that he just promised them that he was going to give.
Gotcha.
So I didn't do a close. And the judge looked, I don't think anybody had done that in front of this judge. And the DA was like, wait a second. I want to get in. Judge is like, your second close is only after defense makes an argument. If he doesn't make an argument, you're done. So we were done. And sure enough, they came back within 20 minutes of not guilty on the case. So it happens sometimes where in the sense of a witness, sometimes I'll get a witness that even on my, so you have a direct exam,
right,
and there's a cross-examination by the other party, and then you have a redirect to sort of clean things up from cross-examination. There have been plenty of times where the cross-examination wasn't very good. I don't think that there was really anything that hurt me in the way of that cross-examination. I won't do a redirect. I'll be like, mm-hmm, okay, that's fine, and we move on. Jurors appreciate that because they want to get these cases. They want to get the facts that they need to make a decision. They don't want to listen to the same facts 5 or 6 or 8 times, because most jurors are smart enough that you give it to them a couple of times and they get it. Okay, that's important. I've got to decide this, and you move on. Same thing is true with the examination of a witness. And generally speaking, the judges are generally older lawyers. They've been in trial a lot, and they were watching the jurors because what they're really looking at as gatekeeper for the whole process is that it's fair to both sides, but it's not unduly burdensome to the jurors and the time that it takes. And so a lot of times judges that think that the lawyers are belaboring something that's just not necessary to be belabored will say, counsel, move on, or they'll make an objection themselves about a question so that they can take a timeout in the action and then stop it and then keep it moving forward. Because this process is one that you want to keep the attention of the individuals who are making decisions about it, and you don't want it to be overly duplicative, I guess, is the best way to describe it. So to answer your question directly, like I said, we like to hear ourselves talk sometimes. There's absolutely the ability for me at times to say, oh, I don't need to do that. And it's really, as you're going along through the process, because you've got it all set up to begin with and you know how it should play out, then you know where you can cut a corner here or there because you think things are to your advantage.
Right.
And it's definitely something that we always consider.
Which everything you've talked about comes with the experience of being a trial attorney. Because how would you like to walk in that the first time?
Well, I remember 25 years ago doing the first trial, a couple of days after I got admitted. It's crazy because you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
You don't know, and you don't really know, because every judge's procedure is a little different. And even though I've done several hundred jury trials, I'm always asking judges now, well, what about this procedure or what about that? Again, where you talk about experience, because I've had judges that have screwed up this or that, or I've had this experience where it didn't go well because a judge or a particular procedure was done that influenced the process. And so those are the sorts of questions I ask now, because I just want to make sure I understand what the rules of the game are and where exactly we're going and how things are going to go. Some judges are really good about explaining all of those sorts of things, and those judges are generally judges who do a lot of trials mm-hmm. and recognize how important it is for the litigants to understand the process that they're going through and how they handle it. Because there's a lot of discretion on what judges, the way that they can handle these trials. And it depends in some circumstances on how, on what you do and how things proceed. Especially, for example, in picking a jury, you think, well, how hard can it be to pick a jury? Well, there's lots of different ways you can do it. You know, there's some judges that ask the litigants on each side to stand up and thank a particular juror and say, thank you very much, but we won't need you today. And there's some impact on the manner in which you pick those people, because again, it's perception by the jurors.
Right.
If there's one particular juror that maybe I have in my 45 minutes of what's called voir dire, questioning the jurors, I have a real heated exchange with an individual just because we have a difference of opinion, and sometimes I like to push a little bit to see how much individuals will push back. If that's the juror that I'd say, I really don't want him, well, I don't pick him to be off of the juror first if I'm the one standing up and saying thank you, because the jurors will understand, oh, that particular juror was really negative towards their case. Why do you think you got rid of him so fast? And stuff like that.
Sure.
That people start speculating about things that will make a difference at the end. And so that sort of knowing the rules. So if we have a judge that just says, you know, just pick the numbers on the piece of paper back and forth, and then once we get everybody marked off, then I will read the jurors that are staying. Well, then nobody's to blame for getting rid of either jurors, and so there's less speculation. But that's important to know in how exactly that process goes, so that you kind of know how you're going to handle getting rid of jurors. Because the process of just picking a juror is not, hey, I want to keep you and you and you. It's excluding people, and nobody likes to be excluded.
Yeah.
Because then they start wondering why they've been excluded.
Sure. You're listening to Legal Talk with Kevin Flesch, and we are discussing the term trial-tested, trial-ready. And that's what we say about Kevin's law firm. And Kevin, and once again, it all starts with picking that attorney that is just exactly that, trial-tested and trial-ready. A lot goes into that. And Kevin, we were talking during the break about, you know, TV shows. There's a lot of cop shows, court shows, and all that. I mean, you know, you see them, may I approach the bench, or the judge calls both attorneys up. I mean, the objections, leading the witness. I mean, does that...
That goes on.
That stuff does happen?
Yes, that happens. So,
and if a judge asks you both to come up, what are they usually? Are they both getting on to you in some way? Or
yeah, it all depends on the situation. A lot of times, so in jury trial, the idea with the jury trial is that you want to get the jurors all the information that you think they need in an adversarial way, so you want to get them all the positive information that they need without getting too far afield. And I'll give you an example of a case that I've got going on right now where we're going to be doing a trial in 2021. And my client, we were suing an insurance company for insurance benefits because he got hurt in a car or in a van that he was using through a business. And he was using it after hours, and there's this whole argument about whether or not it's business related or not. And in this particular case, the individuals know each other because they all went through drug treatment together because they were all convicted of felonies. And the argument from the defense is, well, we shouldn't bring in all of that information because it's not relevant to the determination of why he was driving that car that night, and why it's important. Why is it important for everybody to know that they're felons? And my client's a felon too, mm-hmm. and their clients are felons. And you'd be like, why is that important? Well, it's important because it gives you a sense of their involvement with each other and what they've gone through in life, in the sense that they went through this huge drug treatment program through a community corrections system. And it gives you a sense of what sort of relationship that they have and the bond that they have with each other versus the business owner and his regular employees. And so in normal circumstances, this relationship wouldn't come in because it wouldn't be relevant. But in this case, I've been able to argue to a federal judge, it is relevant. And it may not be helpful for my client, because it may be jurors that look at it and say, well, they're all felons. Why should they get paid for any sort of personal injury? right? But at the same time, I think most people in the community will look at it and say, well, they all screwed up and they've done their debt to society and they've gone through this. But it is important because just like you and I spending time together on the radio or doing other things, this relationship is different than maybe another vendor that I
sure.
spend no time with.
Right.
And that's why I think it is important. And that's why sort of the process that you go through that you really have to think about what's important for a jury to decide. And so talking about these bench conferences, there will be times in a trial where something may or may not come out that we've had a discussion about exactly this issue. And the judges said, yep, you're able to come, you're able to bring it up. And so we're talking about it generally. And then a question is asked that maybe someone objects to because it's outside the scope of what the judge has now said was the parameters that we're allowing this evidence in. So we'll go up to the bench with the judge, and the judges almost universally now in the courtrooms have this basic white noise button, and they hit that white noise so that the jurors then talk to themselves and they can't hear what we're saying up at the bench.
Okay.
And then up at the bench, there's microphones so that we're making a record about a conversation that we're having.
Because the court reporter wants to hear what's happening.
Correct. So the court reporter is generally behind us with a headset on. We've got two microphones, and we may be making argument about this issue that, well, this should be allowed in or this shouldn't be allowed in. And then the judge has to make a ruling right there while the jurors, because you don't want to send the jurors out
sure.
and have a five-minute conversation and then bring them back in because it's just cumbersome.
Right.
So those bench conferences go on, especially in criminal cases. They go on all the time. And there's lots of discussions going on about different things that you just don't want the jurors to hear. There's also times where the judge will bring, I had this happen to me 10 years ago. We had a theft case in Adams County where we didn't think there was ever a theft that was done. We're about halfway through, we've picked the jury about halfway through the prosecution's claim. Judge pulls us up to the bench and he looks at the DA and he says, DA, are we gonna get to this theft that you say that they've done? And the DA's like, yeah, we're gonna get to it. Never got to it. We finished, we did another 2 hours of testimony. There was never a discussion about my client taking things. And so in that particular context, the mm-hmm. judge was saying to the DA, listen, you got to get to this evidence because I'm losing the jurors and you're losing me. Well, when they didn't present the evidence in their case in chief, the judge dismissed the case at halftime. Because you can do that once the prosecution in a criminal case is given all of their best evidence. I can then test that theory with the judge and say, Judge, they haven't presented the evidence even at this stage to warrant a jury making a decision. And the judge can say, you're right, and dismiss the case. And that's what he did in that case at halftime. And so in that bench conference, the judge was kind of saying to the DA, get to it. Because if you're not, I'm not wasting these jurors' time. And in that case, he didn't. He didn't get to it, and the judge dismissed the case. We got rid of the jurors. They never had to make a decision. Wasted a day of their lives, but I mean, they were there to do that process. And so those things go on, and there can be some things that are very mundane that you're dealing with.
Right.
At the same time, there's can be some real fireworks at the bench. The judge could be upset. I could be upset. The other lawyer could be upset about something, and you deal with it as best you can. And if it's something that you can't take care of and it's something that is going to need an extended amount of time to argue, then you have the jurors go out of the room and you make a record about it, and then you bring them back in.
Right. Once again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Legal Talk with Kevin Flesch. Kevin's number, 303-806-8886. 303-806-8886. Just discussing a little bit about being ready for trial and all the things that go into that. And, Kevin, I think another interesting part of this is where, you know, you've got a client and maybe they want them $1 million
yep.
bond or whatever, all that stuff. And so some people say, oh, they should be released on their own cognizance or $200,000, whatever.
Right.
At what stage? That's pretty early on.
It's right away.
In the things.
Yep.
So, but how does that work a lot?
Yeah. So in the event that you have a client, normally, there's three ways to start a criminal prosecution. One, you can be given a summons, which there's no bond argument at that point. Or you can be arrested, where there's a schedule within so the court will set up an actual schedule. So if you charge me with a Class 4 felony of this sort of range, the bond will be $5,000, cash or surety. Domestic violence cases, there's always no bond hold, so the person has to be arrested, taken into custody, and then brought before a judge generally the next day. So, and the third one is where you're arrested, There isn't a bond that's set right away that you have to go into custody and then you're in front of a judge that has to make an argument after understanding what your background is and determine what an appropriate bond is. And the idea with a bond in a criminal case is just making sure that the alleged defendant, the person that's being charged with the crime, is going to show up to all the court appearances and also balance their right to be out in the public mm-hmm. while the case is pending. And so sometimes the courts get really muddled about this safety issue with regard to being in the public while the case is going on
sure.
and they've not been convicted of it. We see this especially in cases of child sex assault or more aggravated adult sex assault sorts of cases where the courts will, or where a person either has a really bad history of failures to appear or just is a flight risk in general. Where the courts will really scrutinize what exactly the bond should be. And then not only do you have the ability to have a cash or surety bond, so that would mean that the court sets a limit, whatever it is, let's say it's $5,000. Sometimes the courts will say, well, you can either only have cash, so you've got to have somebody come up with cash to deposit with the court to allow you to leave the jail. Or if it's a surety, there's a whole industry of individuals out there that will take on that risk, put up the bond, put up the amount that the court is asking you to put up.
So if they're saying, you know, $500,000.
Yes.
How much usually does that client have to come up with?
Yeah, so it's normally a $500,000 bond. You're normally looking at between 10 and 15% of the face value of the bond for the fee for that bondsman to take on that risk. So $500,000, it could be $50,000. It could be $75,000 of fee. So that's what you would have to pay. And then have a co-signer, because that sort of bond, and most likely some sort of real estate or some sort of guarantee that if you run, if the person that's being bonded runs and they have to pay that bond, that they have some way to get paid back for it.
Right.
That's the whole idea. And so that process is early on. And there are some things that happen during that early process, because not only now does the state have the ability to determine the bond by a amount of money of cash, mm-hmm. they also can put other conditions on you, that you have to do pretrial services where you have to go and do urinalysis or breathalyzers, or you have to have GPS monitoring where you have an ankle monitor on your leg or your wrist or somewhere on your body so that they know where you are at all times, or you have to have some sort of alcohol monitoring, maybe a SCRAM unit or something like that, where you have the only way you get out of jail is by agreeing to do those things. And that's before you're convicted of anything. So there's some real arguments that are being made as whether or not that's appropriate, not only constitutionally, but just in general as a matter of due process for making a person do that when they haven't been convicted of a crime yet.
Gotcha.
So they're interesting arguments, and the court has a lot of latitude. And the person is sitting in custody, and depending upon the circumstances, sometimes people are almost willing to stay in custody while the case is progressing, depending upon how severe the punishment may be at the end.
Right. Well, a lot involved. I mean, there's so many.
That's the fun part. That's the interesting part. And we've just touched on sort of the evidence and the opening statement. I mean, there's lots of things that go on.
Yeah, we're going to go through this because I think it's interesting. And I think, too, it lets people see why we say, you know, make sure your attorney, because there's a lot to know here.
There is. And the other thing that's really interesting for people to understand is when you're going through and progressing through the drudgery of the case, which is the pretrial stuff, the discovery and giving information, and it helps clients understand why those things are necessary
right.
when they see it at the end. Now, only about 10%, I'd say, or less, of the people actually go to trial.
Mm-hmm.
So 90% of them are going through all of this, but it's always because it increases the value of the case in the criminal case, or in the civil case, and then in the criminal case, it helps us develop defenses a lot of times to
right.
get things ready.
Right. Well, we'll carry this on.
Very well.
All right. Kevin Flesch, fleschlawfirm.com. That's F-L-E-S-C-H, lawfirm.com. Kevin's number, 303-806-8886. Thank you very much for joining us for Legal Talk.
Views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of Crawford Broadcasting, the station, management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.